Okay, you're very welcome back to the second hour of the 9 till noon show. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. We really appreciate you listening or watching the show. It's great to have you on board, and you're keeping us really busy too on phone lines and what have you. Some of the comments coming in today. Quiltshire is growing invasive Sitka spruce on 1 million acres. That's a million acres we could restore instead of exploiting it for profit. It's state lands, so we should have a say in how it's used, but only if people become motivated and invested in it, I suppose. In relation to TB, there are badgers and deer everywhere. In Wicklow, the locals are tortured with TB due to deer. There's no simple solution to this issue. Badgers need to be vaccinated or culled. But badgers are culled in massive, massive numbers. And I was just curious if, you know, like, but really what I was trying to ask the doctor was, it's not that I'm a, you know, a badger warrior, but we're culling, I'll try and get figures on how many badgers we cull, but we cull an awful lot of badgers. And to be honest with you, no harm if you've ever hit one of them on the roads. But anyway, we cull a lot of badgers, but is it having any impact at all in the control of TB? A caller says, someone from Inishowen would be better off travelling to Dublin for the Donegal match. Roscommon is on the border with Mayo. This is all political. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's, I don't know the motivation for the decision, but there's absolutely no doubt there are people from Donegal who really want to be at that game, but because of the distance and because of the time of the match, are simply not going to go. About the Donegal versus Mayo match, can you advise your listeners that the road between Boyle and Roscommon is closed due to major roadworks, going to be massive traffic delays, they warn. Is that considered, I wonder? Well done with raising the matter. You're always ahead of the curve regarding the Children's Hospital and overspend. Do you know that when the other children wards are amalgamated into the hospital, it'll have less beds? So I'm told by a surgeon. I cannot validate that other than from what I'm being told. Also, maybe a bit of journalism would reveal that operating theatres in Dublin are not operating daily because they don't have staff. We're not even using the limited resources we have. Well, you don't have to go to Dublin to see problems with operating theatres and staff, but I enjoy your comment, or I appreciate your comment. During World War II, our government had a compulsory tillage scheme. Irish food security is a real problem, but government departments are not interested. I know directly from a professor's own mouth that when they were at Department of Agriculture meeting, food diversification was raised. The department official remarked, our only concern is cows farting and how you can help us reduce it. We should have a national home grower scheme that everyone could be a part of. Again, the food supply security is an issue. It won't be raised by our politicians until it's a problem, and then they will blame everyone else. I bought fishing rods and fishing tackle just in case. What do you call people who hoard for fear of a major event or an apocalypse? A survive? What is there's a word for it? You're not quite at that yet with a couple of fishing rods, but hey, no harm, no harm in having them. Let me see. This Sunday, the 8th of June, 40 years on, I wonder how many people remember the night. What happened on the 8th of June 40 years ago? Well, Barry McGuigan won the world title by beating Eusebio Pedrosa. What an achievement, what a night. It was indeed, and I do remember that, unfortunately. It's great to have the memory, but it's not so great being as old as you can remember. And then the title was kind of handed away, if my memory serves me correctly. He fought in the desert then. You know, this guy from Clonus. There was an open air fight in the desert, and I think it was, is it Steve Cruz he fought? And I'm genuinely doing that from memory, and I could be really wrong, but I remember he fought against Steve Cruz, and my recollection of it, I don't know, was it the 8th, 9th round? Maybe it was sooner, or maybe it was later, but completely dehydrated, not built for such a climate. I may have misremembered that, but as much as I remember him winning the title, I do seem to recall him losing it against a fellow called Steve Cruz, and it was out in the open, I think. In my head, I see a ring in the desert, right? I'm not quite sure if it was a ring in the desert, but I don't see any crowds. Now, obviously, there were crowds there, but I might be misremembering. But thank you for that, because I'm certainly actually going to go on YouTube now and see if I can remind myself of that, because obviously it's tied in to memories of watching it with my father and brother. You know, stuff that you can't replace. But that's my recollection of that. I wonder, am I right? I'll check. Right, huge reaction from you, of course, in relation to our conversations yesterday with Dr. Anya Keating and Dr. Kira Steele. They are one of two of 170 doctors, consultants, medical professionals, both in the hospital and around the county, who who wrote a letter effectively saying, look, you know, I don't want to paraphrase it, but what I heard was, if we don't get a surgical hub, you know, it is the next step in the downgrade of Letterkenny University Hospital. And there are people who were warning about this downgrade 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's not necessarily a planned downgrade, but, you know, certainly the direction of traffic. If you lose consultants, if you lose resources, you lose the ability to operate as a hospital. It's the sixth busiest hospital in the country. It's the second busiest Model 3 hospital. There's been generations of underspending in relation to it. And now the hope was a surgical hub could, you know, retain and maybe improve things going forward. That surgical hub, it's been decided now, will go to Sligo. That decision was made months ago, right? And it's bedded in. It's going to take a lot of unravelling. I still have hope that it might be unravelled. We're still persisting with trying to get a word with the health minister. I really want to get something on the record that she's going to commit to review this, that she's going to get commit to get the HSC in the West Northwest to have a look at this again. As I do note, you know, I'm not being critical of other media outlets. It's going to sound like I am, but I'm not. But thankfully, RTE yesterday, they did take on a Donegal GP to talk about this letter. 171 people in the county. It's never happened before. It's unprecedented, seeking a meeting with the health minister. And the health minister was on RTE this morning. Now, I really hope I'm wrong, but the health minister, and RTE covered this themselves yesterday morning, and they had the health minister sitting there in the studio. And she was asked about a number of things, CHI and what have you. And they could have followed up their own story and asked, are you committed to meeting the Minister for Health? The only way I can imagine that that question was asked is if it was off the table to ask that question. In other words, you can have access to the minister, but just don't ask about the letter from Donegal GP just yet. I really, really hope that that's not the case. But I sit in this chair and I know the story, right? Any journalist worth their salt would follow their own story up from yesterday morning. It's not their story specifically, it's all of our story. They would have followed up, Dr. McGuinness on with them, wasn't it? They would have followed up their own story yesterday. And as far as I'm aware, unless I missed it, they didn't ask a follow-up question to their own story. And the only way I can imagine that could happen, because they had a good 10, 15 minutes with her, I think, is if it was off the table not to ask that question. And that's very troubling, and it shouldn't be the case. And I would love to know if it was the case. I really would love to know the case. I hope it was a journalistic oversight and not a decision, not a request not to ask that question. And I'll leave it up to you to decide what the story is. Emma Gover, the wee Donegal mommy, messaged in. After listening to Dr. Arnie Keating and Dr. Kira Steele on Greg Hughes on Highland Radio, myself and Betty Holmes, after a lengthy phone call, have decided to postpone for now an upcoming meeting that we had been planning for healthcare advocates and campaigners this month in regards to a lack of funding and under-resourcing of Letterkenny University Hospital. The reason for this is that at this present moment in time, we believe it is more important than ever to put our 100% support behind those 171 doctors who've written to the Minister for Health requesting an immediate meeting in regards to awarding of the surgical hub outside of LUH. We would encourage all people in Donegal to get behind these doctors too and give them 100% support. We'll update you as soon as we can. Now, if you wanted to, I'm not a campaigner, I'm just sitting in the seat, but if you wanted to email the health minister to back those doctors, you could. I know there are templates going about. I'm not a fan of templates. I think just your own words, you know, use AI, whatever it is, just a couple of lines if you want to. Minister's office at health.gov.ie. Minister's office at health.gov.ie. If you want to back those medical professionals and say to them, you know, enough is enough. We can't be ignored. We need this hub. We need a hospital. You heard from Dr. Anya Keaton, the way she outlined how the hospital could degrade in time without that surgical hub. Right. Hi, Greg. In my honest opinion on why this country is seriously seeing all our services in a state of collapse or already not fit for purpose is because we've politicians and ministers who are in their position not through merit but by securing a position by a family name or being given it for a favour. Seriously, if you sit back and listen to them, it's not hard to see the country's being run by imbeciles whose only real intention is to never answer a question truthfully as to run out their term as easy as possible. Not picking on one in particular, but how did Helen McEntee get another position after showing how inapt she is as a minister? I'm torn on Minister McEntee. I think she did a lot of good as Minister for Justice. I mean, obviously, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of her role, but particularly in terms of women's safety and what have you. Rosina Tona here. Finally, we're getting somewhere. Fair play to the doctors for coming together and speaking out. After our meeting in the hospital at the end of April, I do believe public reps and hospital management are making an effort too. So with the doctors now pushing forwards, this can really go somewhere. Thanks, Rosina. I appreciate your comment there. Greg, doctors are standing up for the people of Donegal. Where our politicians have failed to do so. Listen, there's an element of orchestration that goes on with these things. I think the politicians have been privy for some time as to the concerns of the doctors. Maybe they've worked with them to not plan this out as such, but to work with them to perhaps maybe allow the doctors to speak out first and then back that up with sort of, you know, political commentary. I think there is a... And not in a bad way necessarily. It depends. I don't agree. I would do things differently, right? But I think there's certainly an element of orchestration to try and have the greatest impact with the campaign. Let me put it like that. What is the views of the Donegal government rep on Sligo being the new hub? We know what opposition representatives' views are. Speak to and challenge government reps on the issue. Well, firstly, neither government rep would speak to me. Patrick Gallagher doesn't want to speak. Charlie McConnell has a long-standing policy of not speaking to me because he believes I'm too opinionated and anti-government, which I, both of those, well, I might be opinionated. You know, it's not the news here. I'm entitled to have a say. But anyway, I'm certainly not anti-government. I don't care who delivers as long as they deliver for Donegal. But anyway, both of them have released statements saying they fully support the doctors, in fairness. So whether they speak, it's completely up to them. But both of them are fully supportive of Letterkenny getting a surgical hub. And they are saying they're using their contacts and their channels to try and ensure that that happens, along with three opposition TDs. Okay, that's all that. Let's take a break. Back shortly. Okay, so obviously we have a role to platform people's concerns as it relates to the handling of the defective concrete blocks crisis as people seek to improve the scheme. So we also too have to recognise if positive inroads are being made in that regard, sure, why wouldn't we? Deputy Charles Ward of the 100% Redress Party is with me on the show now. Good morning to you, Charles. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning to all the listeners.
So what are the potential positives here?
So basically what we have is the minister is going to take to cabinet basically some of the concerns that we have told him. And we expect that side by side we'll go ahead for families that are vulnerable.
Talk to me about the significance of that, Charles, because, you know, I want to take it as we go. You and I, to some extent, are very familiar with this, but what does that mean? Yeah.
So, for example, if we take, for example, the Gibsons and young Emma, who's severely disabled, they're in their home. Their home, it's got defective concrete, needs to be demolished. They cannot move anywhere else. Mm. The house is designed to suit Emma and all the equipment that she requires. So what their plan was to build on the site next to the house, but they weren't allowed to. This will allow them to build that house. And when their house is complete, their new home's complete, they can move themselves and Emma into this home and then demolish the house that's left. This is why we get side by side.
Brilliant. So but it gives a bit of... It gives a bit of flexibility, doesn't it, which in terms of planning, yeah, which is very welcome.
It was very welcome. But what we need to realise too is we have this case here, but we have hundreds of cases, maybe even thousands of cases where this could be the case instead of, for example, when this scheme does kick off properly and there's thousands of people going forward, we have nowhere to accommodate them. But if they have the land to do it, I would be looking at, if they have the land to do it, let them build on that land and demolish the house afterwards, because then we've only got 28 rental properties on daft.ie in Donegal. Where are we going to put the thousands? Mm-hmm. This is a positive step, but it's in the wording. You know, we got to be cautious.
Very limited circumstances. Very limited circumstances for vulnerable families.
Yeah, but what I'd like to say about that too is if you took very vulnerable, our banks now are looking at it and they're saying anybody with a defective home is regarded as a vulnerable family. Yeah. And I think that that is the lived experience for 100% of us. You know, we're not we don't have the luxury of going into a safe, secure home, and that's the foundation of everything in your life. Is your home is your castle and your family. When there's something wrong with your home, it does affect people.
Yeah, we saw an increase announced in terms of the cap for those who were sort of, I suppose, going to construction on the scheme. It does seem now there's going to be a retrospective element to it. The increased scheme cap and rates will now apply to all applicants who incurred costs since 29th of March 2024. Will that catch the majority of people, or most of them, or some of them? Or
it will help a vast majority, but this is where the devil is in the detail again. That date will mean that if your completion is prior to this, you will not qualify for a retrospective payment. And this is where we leave. This is the thing. This leaves people behind, which is wrong.
Yeah. So in other words, if you completed your works before the 29th of March, you will not avail of the increased cap and rates.
Yeah.
But if you if you started after that, and you haven't completed.
Yeah. So you take, for example, you'll know some. Let's say a guy called Paddy started his build. He finished in December 2023. Completion's in. They're in for Christmas. They're 40 grand down, 50 grand down, whatever they're down. That retrospective payment would have helped them. Currently, the way it sits, they won't get that.
Okay, but if I started on the 30th of March and I had a fantastic run of it and got into my house in January 25, completed, would I still get the top up?
You will get the top up.
Right. There's always going to be people left behind, very sadly. How significant is an increase in time allowed for remediation works? It's quite a dramatic increase, actually, really, if the truth be told.
Look, that is what's needed. Because what we've got currently going on, and I'm speaking to builders on the ground here, is we don't have enough contractors. Mm-mm. We don't have enough block layers. We don't have enough, you know. And this is the scheme only starting off, you know. If we take the numbers from last year, 382 homes completed in Donegal. That's not including DCB homes. What we need in and around 1,200 homes built every single year. We're so far off the pace, and we can't ramp it up because we can't get the qualified bodies in. And this is why I keep on saying this. We need to look outside. We need to start looking at a major construction company to come in. If this is the biggest scheme in the state, why would we be giving it to a local authority to administer? This is putting pressure on the local authority. Let's get a company in that can do this.
There are other flexibilities being proposed in planning as well, which might be helpful. Adapting dwellings, a little bit of flexibility on things like pitched roofs and what have you.
Yeah. Look, Greg, this is the way it's got to be. If we're going to fix this housing crisis that we currently have, 380 houses a year in Donegal is not going to do it. It's not even going to help us grow. So what we need to do is we need to get the proper planning regulations in place where we have inspections and people come in, and we need to think outside the box and get on with it. You know what I mean? This is the fact of the matter. We have to get on with it, because what we've got coming down the line is we've got a DCB, a concrete defective crisis going on in Donegal, but also our children are growing up and living in their childhood bedrooms, becoming young adults, when they don't have the same opportunities we had when we were 19, 20, going to rent a place. Nobody could rent a place at 20 years old now. You're talking, what, 1,500 for for
it's crazy.
Two or three bedrooms.
Can I just clarify something? Sorry, because I don't want this to be attributed to you either. There was a number of announcements made by the housing minister today. When I talk about a bit of flexibility in planning, that's across the board.
So until I mentioned that it's
DCB specific, but in terms of adapting properties, that's more general.
Just to be clear, I made that mistake.
That's more than welcome.
We have to go down.
It all fits in, of course, as well.
We have to go down the bungalow bliss route again. That's what this country needs if we're going to sort this out. And when it comes to the defective concrete crisis and it going to cabinet and then it comes to the housing committee, well, part of my deal when I joined my for my speaking rights was I negotiated that anything to do with defective concrete and the housing committee, I will be on that. So where we have Brian Stanley and Richard Boyd Barrett going in doing their normal thing with the housing committee, anything to do with defective concrete in Ireland, in Donegal, I am the representative for, and I will be, I will have the vote too, and I'll have a hands-on for the defective concrete when it comes to the housing committee.
Just one thing about this 29th of March 2024 question, sorry, because I'm just looking at the wording here. Say your build straddles that date. So there's half the build beforehand and half the build afterhand. Does the rates increase cover the entirety of that construction or just any work that would have continued after the 29th of March 2024?
So you have your commencement and then you have your completion. Your completion is your finish date. Mm-hmm. So if that was over to that, in my eyes, and the paperwork would say it, you completed your build after that date.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you completed your build on the 30th of March 2024, you're of the view that you will be entitled to the increased rate?
Yeah, I would say that, yeah. And I would like to see, look, this is why I'm here. There will be cases that come to me and that is the state and I will take these cases and go and fight for them. Okay.
Well, we might get clarity on that ASAP because I think people listening that might
think,
all right.
Of course, and then there will be people on that date. There's, you know what I mean? There's no doubt about it. But look, it is a positive outlook if you look at it like this. You know, if you said to us, we met the housing minister 3 weeks ago, we said side by sides, we said the 10%.
He's listening, hopefully. That's all you can want,
there's
isn't
no
it?
Doubt.
Yeah. Credit to him if he is.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. He is listening. And it's about now, it's about keep pushing it and keep pushing it. And we've got to keep pushing it because it's over now. We have to make sure that we get this scheme up and right because we've had two failed schemes. Now, let the defective concrete amendment bill go in and then we actually tweak it to work for the people in Donegal because we've had years of misery and this time it ended.
All right, listen, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it. That's Deputy Charles Ward there. And as I say, some critical questions there about, if you finished your property on the 1st of April 2024, you're going to want to know definitively whether or not you're going to get the increased rates. Charles Ward's of the opinion that you will. I've got my fingers crossed that you will. I'd be really keen to get some clarity in relation to that one. Now, Ulster University recently conducted a study examining the cost of living on children's participation in sports. So that's the cost of living and its impact on children's participation in sport. 80 to 100 parents were surveyed across Northern Ireland examining the cost of living effect on sport and social activity. Dr. Maria O'Kane is lecturer in healthcare science at Ulster University and joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
Right, okay. So what were some of the key findings of this study?
Yeah, so this is research we conducted last year. So we had 855 parents or guardians in Northern Ireland completed the survey. And really what we found, and I suppose it's important to bear in mind that 90% of this population, so the vast majority were in employment. So I'd ask you to keep that in mind when you hear some of the key findings around 35% of parents had reduced the spending on sport and physical activity for their children since the onset of the cost of living crisis in 2021. Added to that, 30% told us they were unable to afford the equipment and clothing that their children need to take part in physical activity and in sport. And I suppose one of the more stark findings was that almost a quarter of parents or guardians reported using credit or debt to cover the cost of sport and physical activity for their children. So some really important findings in terms of children's participation, both in sport and in physical activity, and how parents are really struggling to cover the costs of those activities for their children.
Yeah, putting financial and emotional pressure on them, because it's clear most parents are doing all they can to continue their child's participation in sport. Clearly, they're seeing the benefits of it.
Absolutely. So this was a population. So we asked them about their support for physical activity for their children. And the majority were really supportive of sport and physical activity. 85%, so the vast majority, said that sport and physical activity were more important than ever for their children to manage stress and manage worry. So this population group clearly saw the benefit of their children taking part in sport and physical activity, but they were just really struggling to afford it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the way things are going, reading in the papers today about, groceries still going up, everybody has their tipping point. You know, there is a point you breach for everyone. It doesn't matter what your income levels are, but obviously if you're in lower incomes, that comes sooner. So, it presumably is a worsening problem as, the cost of the basics continues to rise.
Absolutely. And within the research, we asked questions to collect data on socioeconomic status. And actually, when we break down the findings across six different indicators of socioeconomic status, we can see that there are particular groups who have been worse affected by the cost of living crisis. So if you take, for example, single parent families, families where they're in receipt of benefits, where a parent is unemployed, you really see the increase in stress and pressure that those families are under. So if we take, for example, the question around using credit or debt, we can see that 50% of those who were unemployed reported using credit or debt to cover the cost of sport and physical activity.
But what I'd be worried, that's worrying in and of itself, of course, but what sacrifices were they making to the point whereby there was no more fat to cut and you had to start borrowing?
Absolutely. Yeah, so when we followed up with parents, so after the survey, I conducted almost 30 interviews with parents, and I suppose that really gave us the context in which, and adding some detail to the findings and the statistics that we had from the survey, but parents told us how they had sacrificed their own activities for their children to take part in sport. They were no longer doing the things that make them happy or relieve stress and the benefits that they get from sport and physical activity. So they were sacrificing that for their children. They had tried to hold off as long as they could from withdrawing their children from sport. There was a real sense that children were no longer getting exposure to the various sports and physical activities that they would have done, maybe for the eldest child, for example. So parents are doing what they can to ensure their children can continue to participate. They're really aware of the benefits and they're supportive of sport. I suppose it comes down to money and just not being able to afford it. And especially when you have a family maybe participating in a sport that is seen to be a bit more expensive than some of the others, it's the implications that has for children that are talented and maybe moving into playing county level or an elite sport, and that's just not a possibility.
If it's GAA, it's your gum shield, it's your football boots, soccer, it's the same. If it's swimming, it could be the bus to the swimming, it could be the membership. If it's athletics, it could be the spiked shoes or the proper shorts. It's not a luxury. These are the essentials for it. But obviously, the more active our children are, the better it is for the state, in terms of their physical health and less dependency, we would hope, on the NHS, HSE into the future. Their mental health, so less support, you would hope, in terms of mental health services, more socialising, more community integration. Everything points to the fact that, and I'm not sure in your position as a lecturer at Ulster University, if you can comment to this, but everything points to the fact that the Stormont or the London government or whatever should be doing all they can to help support families to support their children in sport.
Absolutely. So we know that in Northern Ireland, less than one in five children get enough physical activity or meet physical activity guidelines. So our levels of physical activity are really low to start with. Research from England has shown that for every pound that's invested in sport, there's £4 worth of benefit to the government and to society. Data, it's 10 years old now, so probably the figures have increased, but research has shown that if we can see a 1% change in the levels of our adolescents meeting physical activity guidelines, so just 1%, that would have an 800 million saving over the course of their lifetime in terms of the mental health costs, the healthcare costs, the quality of life, their life expectancy. So there's real benefits to be harnessed. And I suppose one of the things that we have done as a result of this research is come up with 6 policy asks. So things that we're asking the government specifically for around making PE time in schools mandatory. So at the minute, it's a recommendation. And we know that from data on the Children's Sport Participation and Physical Activity Report, children aren't getting the 120 minutes of PE that's recommended per week. We've asked for some rather simple or easy wins, I suppose, around an online portal for parents to be able to access what free or low-cost opportunities exist in their area, so that we know in different parts of the communities there's really good work ongoing around free activities. But parents in the interviews told us that unless you're in the right Facebook groups or the WhatsApp groups, you maybe don't know that those exist. Mm-hmm. So that would be one way that we could provide up-to-date, localised information for families that they can see in their area what opportunities exist that are free or are local.
Up until now, we've been talking about how parents, the sacrifices they make or the decisions they make to keep their children active in sport. Unless I missed you referencing this, does this survey catch those that simply can't afford to send their children to sport? So maybe they have a budding GAA star, or maybe they have a very talented girl who's a future Northern Ireland soccer player, for an example, but they simply cannot afford for them to participate in sport, because that's a whole different group of individuals altogether.
Yeah. And I think it's important to say that 90% of this population were employed. So probably what we're seeing is slightly better than what the real life situation might be in the communities. That tends to be the case with survey-based research. It tends to be people who've been educated to higher levels, for example, that tend to participate. So what I'm reporting here might be a better case scenario. And I suppose we captured that within the interviews around parents saying they couldn't afford for their child to progress, they couldn't afford the tournament costs, the hotel stays if they're going to a competition overseas, or in the Republic of Ireland, for example. And really what comes next, I suppose, is so important in terms of surveying sports clubs on the island of Ireland. So from parents, we got some good insights as to how sports clubs support children from low-income families or those who are struggling financially. But what we'll see there is how clubs do that. So how that comes to life, how that is implemented and actioned within clubs, and some of the work that's ongoing. So that survey is live at the minute, and we would hope to have that data in the coming months then to really share best practice among different sports. You mentioned the GAA there. We heard some really good examples of swap shops and payments over the course of a year, not all in one lump. So there's some really good examples across various sports, but I think the important thing is to share that best practice among the clubs and the sports on the island of Ireland, and that's the next piece of this puzzle, I suppose.
All right, Dr. Maria O'Kane, lecturer in healthcare science at Ulster University. A team worked on that, including Terman's Roisin McCafferty as well, too, who was involved in that research paper, so a special shout out to her. Thanks so much for your time, Maria.
Brilliant, thank you.
Slán, thank you very much indeed. Now, we're joined on the programme by Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine, with special responsibility for forestry, farm safety and horticulture, Minister Michael Healy-Ray. Good morning, Minister. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and thank you for the opportunity of allowing me on your show.
No, it's good to have you on. Now, just before I get into what we're going to talk about, just coincidentally, we were speaking to well-known Donegal vet Dr. Gerard Rorty a little earlier on, and he was backing the Irish Natural Hill Farmers Association's concerns about the government's plans to purchase land for national parks, particularly regarding the potential impact on farmers. You know, he was talking of the difficulty in young farmers getting on the ladder, you know, buying a pocket of land or what have you. Also, the fact that the state in your own county has been paying double the asking price effectively for some of this land, skewing the cost of land more generally. This is government policy. You're part of that government. How concerned are you? Do you share any concerns or do you think this is the right way forward?
Well, no, I can understand 100% why that vet, and because of his life's experience, of course, he'd be dealing with farmers every day. One of the biggest problems that farmers have, if a young person is coming on board and we want succession, this government is committed to allowing an orderly progression of younger farmers take you over our family farms. And of course, if they want to expand and purchase land, you don't want a situation where the state would be competing with young people when it comes to purchasing lands. Now, the amount of instances and the amount of times that that would have actually happened, I don't want it to be exaggerated. I know it has happened where the state has bought and might be buying different places, but it wouldn't be an awful lot. It wouldn't be an awful lot of instances that it would happen. So I don't want it to be exaggerated, but of course, if it happens to one individual, that's one individual that might, you know, you don't want people to be put out if they're looking to buy next door to them, and you don't want a situation where the state is competing with them. But sometimes the state has to do things, and if it's deemed by the department that land is wanted for whatever purpose, well, you know, we just hope that it wouldn't happen too much. That's the way I'd word it too.
Yeah, indeed. Is it something that we need to have more of a conversation on? Because it kind of does talk to where we are going in this country. What are we going to do? You know, are we just going to be a country of, you know, solar panel farms, effectively, you know, most of Donegal becoming a, and this is an exaggeration, of course, a national park? You know, there are big questions about the future of farming in this country, the future of agriculture, our own food security, our ability, you know, to work the land. And I referenced this to the vet a little earlier on. I just think as we head to 2030 and we're going to miss our climate charges, climate targets by a mile, that the scrutiny is going to go to the low-hanging fruit, which is farmers, which is agriculture. You know, do we not need a proper national conversation about where we are going and what the plan is, and if this buying up of land to extend our national parks, for an example, is the right way forward?
Well, Greg, the first thing I'd say to you is when it comes to farmers and off-farm income, whether that's people who want to put up turbines, if their land is suitable to turbines, or if people want to put in solar farms, you must remember those two forms of renewable energy which the government supports. You actually can continue with your farming practices, as you know. The solar panels can be constructed in such a way that sheep could graze in those areas, and you also have the situation, of course, where the turbines actually take up or disturb farming practices in a very small way, but they mean an awful lot when it comes to off-farm income. And so renewable energies and the way we do that is something that the government supports. But also, we want our farmers to have as many avenues of income as possible, because sometimes, you know, an enterprise like that can make an awful difference to a family. Okay. And again, when it comes to the transition, we want to ensure that young people will be able to take over the farms and that will be commercially viable for them to do so, because that is so important.
We are heading into, listen, it's busy all year round for farmers, but it's a particularly busy time now. And very sadly, we get figures of real people dying in instances on the farm. You know, the majority of them are avoidable. I mean, sometimes something is completely unavoidable. But in terms of, you know, farm deaths and also serious injuries where it's, you know, potentially one person working the farm and they need to look at maybe the safety practices to ensure that they're there to do that. You're impressing in your role on farmers and everyone, I suppose, on farms, visiting farms or in the countryside, to be extra careful this summer to see if we can limit to the absolute best possible the amount of serious injury and fatalities.
Well, I am, Greg, because farm safety is my responsibility. The promotion of farm safety, farmers' well-being, whether it's their physical or mental health, that is my responsibility. It's a role I take very seriously. And the department and I are providing a range of supports and initiatives to promote farm safety, their health and well-being. There's a fund of €2.5 million which will be used towards promoting farm safety. We'll be working and are working very closely with organisations, the farm organisations, but also with the HSE and the Farm Safety Partnership, in trying to ensure that we encourage farmers. The work you're doing is dangerous in many instances. Of course it is, no more than going onto a building site. But there is an awful difference between going onto a building site and going onto a farm, and that if you go onto a building site, for example, you couldn't dare go in there without all the proper PPE gear. And if you were working at heights, you'd have to be harnessed, you'd have to have your boots with your steel toe caps, and all of your working methods would be with safety as a priority focus. But unfortunately, on our farms, we have a disproportionate amount of accidents, fatal, and which also result in very serious injuries. And every one of us have friends and have people that have unfortunately died at work on their farms, but also who have had very serious accidents. And one thing that I cherish on our farms is the fact that today there are young people going to be working, and for the rest of the summer they'll be driving tractors, and we want them. We want them to be driving machinery. We want them to be working, but we want them to be so conscious of the fact that they have a big role of responsibility, so they have to be safe. And no matter what job you're at today on a farm, no matter what you're doing, if the job wasn't to be done at all, and I know it's very important that the work gets done, but the most important thing is that you get to go home this evening and close the door behind you, and that you're in one piece, and that you're safe and sound. Because the horror and the everlasting effect that it can have if there's a serious injury, or worst of all, a death or a loss, that'll never be forgotten by a family or by a community. So we want to do everything we can to ensure that. I always say about farming, an awful lot of the time you have to work alone. And it's very smart to come along and say, oh, well, you shouldn't work alone. Mm. But look,
it's not reality.
That's one thing. But in reality, but when you are going at what I would call a more dangerous job, don't ever be slow about saying, you know, I'm going to leave that after me. Sometimes the best job whoever did was the job who mightn't do it all. And get help, get somebody to come with you. And if it's knocking, for example, a dangerous tree, don't dare go at something like that on your own. Because, look, and I know money can be scarce and everything, but it would pay you so well to get in a proper person that would be used to that, a younger person maybe. Because every one of us, as we get older, we get a bit slower. We mightn't be as quick on our feet. We mightn't be as agile as what we were before. And you just must mind yourself and your number one priority. Of course, your farming is important. Your animals are important. But the most important thing is yourself and the people that are working with you to be careful. We will do everything we can, working with the organisations. And the government is really, really committed to ensure the safety of our farmers and to try and ensure that that we will minimise the debts, because every debt is a debt too much, and predominantly an awful lot of these accidents that can happen through dealing with livestock, machinery, working from heights, working saws, all of those sort of things. There are so many things watch you. You really have to be on your game, you know.
And of course, we focus on, and we've both mentioned it. We focus on the deaths. Unfortunately, 5 of the 11 deaths this year to date. 45% were confirmed workplace incidents that were on the farm. But it's the 4,500 non-fatal incidents on Irish farms every year where someone's got life-changing injuries, a broken leg, a lost leg, God knows what, and that's a huge number. And there are resources there, and we appreciate you, Minister, coming on and helping us get the word out there. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, take care. Thanks so much.